Hi there, this is Photography of Director Podcast, and my name is Vitaly Boxer. I'm a cinematographer and I work on all sorts of different projects, and I've decided to do a podcast about other filmmakers. This week we're chatting with my good friend and film director Joe Eckhart. We delve into Joe's past, starting as a PA on large sets for the likes of people like Nicolas Cage, and then moving into the director's chair to shoot films ranging from micro to multi-million dollar budgets. Joe definitely brings not only an artistic but a strong business perspective to making films. For filmmakers who haven't thought through about the distribution of their films and the business side of filmmaking, this is a must hear. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes with a video or audio only feed. Just look up Photography of Director. And all the links to the films we chat about can be found on photographyofdirector.com. Please enjoy the show. Boom. Welcome to Photography of Director, the second coming. No, the second version. Podcast 2. Are you happy to be on?
I'm very happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
So let me tell the folks who we have. We have Joe Eckhart, and he's a director. Basically, he's been doing this for a long time, and he's doing a bunch of other things, post-supervising, directing, kicking some ass on set sometimes, and a lover. Is that accurate?
Sometimes.
So I'm having you on because, one, you're a good friend of mine, and we've done a lot of things together, and but I wanted to, you have an interesting past and an interesting sort of way that you got to where you are. I don't know if you want to go into that a bit, but tell us how you got into directing and where did you start from?
I started in this wonderful business almost 20 years ago now in New York. I was bored in college and didn't know what I wanted to do, so I took a year off and I got a job on movie sets as a production assistant. My uncles were our big sound team in New York. So they got me a job on a movie called I'm Not Rappaport. The last three or four days of the movie I worked on. It was a movie with Walter Matthau and Ozzie Davies based on the Broadway show by the same name. And I loved it. I was like, wow, this is a great business. Okay. So I basically hung out with every department on jobs after that. I just kept working for almost 4 years straight as a PA. And hung out with the camera department. They taught me how to use cameras, hung out with the, you know, the grips and the light and department, learned how to do their jobs. And eventually I felt I was comfortable enough, and I rented a Bolex camera, you know, Super 8 and a 16 millimeter camera. And I ran around Manhattan shooting my own little silent short films. When I would, you know, match it up with music for
what,
a soundtrack.
What year is this? What year is this all happening?
1995, almost 20 years ago now, yeah.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah, time flies. Yeah. You know, I would do it the old-fashioned way. You know, Moviola viewer and splice the film together, and the cut didn't work, I'd take tape off and redo it.
And that made you still want to be a filmmaker after doing that?
I still wanted to do it. But you know, helped me become an editor, because I understood what those terms mean, because that's what the Avid uses. It uses the real film terms.
So wait, what happened? That I don't know all of this history, actually. So you started to make small little films, directing them and writing them.
Directing, writing, lighting them, everything.
Oh, you were the one-man band.
I was the one-man band. Yeah, come on. You're a PA. You have no money.
What happened to any of those films?
I still have them, most of them.
Oh, you're going to have to show our listeners some of that work.
They're in the vault.
They're never coming out. Never. Well, we're going to have to digitize them and get them up there.
Yeah.
So after you did that for a while, you PA'd. You were still in New York, right? But at some point you moved to L.A.,
I was in New York, yeah, from 95 to almost – in 1998, I made my first trip to L.A. I used to work for Nicolas Cage as his on-set assistant.
Yeah, yeah. So you skipped ahead sort of. That's what I was trying to get to, that you went an unusual route.
What I did – all right, so let me back up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah,
so
no, back up to the point, because you have an interesting story. See, I know this guy. So you were a PA, and somehow they picked you up to be an assistant for these guys, right, these big shots.
I was working on a movie in Atlantic City called Snake Eyes, starring Nick Cage, directed by Brian De Palma. And when you're shooting nights in the casino, you have a lot of tourists, and you're sitting there with Nicolas Cage, you tend to have a lot of people, you know, migrate towards him. So it was kind of the PA's job to just kind of surround Nick and keep him safe on set and keep all the tourists and look-you-lose away from him. And the rest of the PAs were kind of always kissing his ass, you know, hey, who, you know, I love you in Face Off, and you're great in Leaving Las Vegas, and blah, blah, blah. And he hates that.
And no one was like, you really sucked in this movie.
And I turned around and was like, who are you? No. So I actually respected the fact that he was trying to work, and I left him alone. And that got his attention. And they asked me if I wanted to come to Montreal to finish the rest of the movie there. So we did. And then
so but basically over, basically this will teach a lot of PAs a lesson that leave the goddamn actor alone.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
He's there working. Leave him alone.
So he noticed you basically because you left him alone and he said, fly with me.
Pretty much. So I went to Montreal for another month and a half and 2 months, finished the movie. And then it was done. I went back to New York.
Well, no, but what were you doing? What were you doing after he invited you? Like, what was your role?
I was his liaison between him and the set.
So you were done being a PA?
I was done being a PA. I was his PA, essentially.
Right. Like his personal, well, sort of a personal assistant, no?
It wasn't. Yeah, but I only dealt with the set stuff. I didn't have to deal with the laundry and, going to go buy him, stuff at the drugstore. None of that shit.
Right.
I was dealing primarily only with the set. I dealt with what scene we're doing next, start prepping him for that, what departments need access to him in order to do their jobs to prep for the set, for the scene.
I assume you got a raise.
I got a little bit one, yeah. PA still makes shit, so.
Oh, so they still sort of labeled you that, but you weren't his, like, on the next movie, weren't you his, like, official bigger assistant where he sort of took you
he
into
had
more?
One. He had one as his official guy that had to deal with all the personal stuff.
I see. Life. So you're always just basically doing set stuff with him.
Just
always.
Movies. Whatever movie we're on, that's all I dealt with. That's it. Right. I didn't deal with the personal life.
Is there a story? I mean, first of all, that's cool that basically you did like a couple of movies in L.A. or one or two, and then immediately you're working for Nick Cage.
I did. Well, at that point, I hadn't done one in L.A. yet. So Snake Eyes was first in Atlantic City, in Jersey, right? And then the next one was 8mm. Coincidentally, he came to New York and did a couple of weeks of exteriors there. And I got on the show, and then they assigned me to his team right away because I already had a relationship with him and his people. And then that movie as well, I left him alone. He did his job, and then he was at the end of the New York run. He's like, we're going to L.A. to finish it there. Do you want to come and join us? I said, sure. So I flew out to L.A. and spent the next 2-3 months working on 8mm out there. And then when I was done, I went back to New York. And then Nick came to New York to do a film a few months later called Bringing Out the Dead, directed by Martin Scorsese. And that was like 4 months of all-night shooting.
So you met Martin. Winter. You met Mr. Martin.
I met Marty, yeah. That guy's amazing. I got to watch him. I got to watch him work.
So I mean, this is important not because you worked for Nick. I mean, that's cool in itself, but you did get to see some of these big time directors, sort of how they operate.
Yeah, Barry Levinson. I worked on movie Sleepers. I watched him direct. I watched Chris Columbus, Joe Schumacher, Brian De Palma.
Did you actually hang out on set and like literally watch them?
Yeah,
like staring
especially
at them?
On Bringing Out the Dead. I would stand right behind Video Village because that's where Nick Cage's director's chair was. That's where his central was on set. So I got to hang out there while he was working.
That's pretty cool.
Talk to these guys.
So what happened? I mean, after Nick Cage, you had another stint. You did this for a little bit longer, right?
So then after we did Bringing Out the Dead, I got a call from Nick's people saying, you want to come to L.A.? We're doing Gone in 60 Seconds. So that was spring of 99. So then at that point, I drove cross country with my buddy and moved to L.A. and stayed there for almost 10 years after that. But after Gone in 60 Seconds was over, I needed a job. Nick was going to go to Greece to go do Captain Corelli's Mandolin, and they had no budget to bring his whole entourage. So, of course, I'm the first to go. I stayed behind. His agent was over at CAA. One other agent at CAA was looking for an assistant for Cuba Gooding Jr. So they got my resume to Cuba, and then I met with Cuba, and we had an interview or two, and then he hired me. And I ended up working with Cuba for the next 2.5-3 years as his guy. But for Cuba, I did his personal life and the business life. I did everything.
So, I mean, that's cool. I'm sure you had fun, like, sort of traveling around and doing that. But at what point did you say, this is enough, I got to do my own thing? Because you stopped at a certain point, right?
Yeah, I stopped.
Or did you get fired? Let's be honest.
Both. Cuba and I had like an old married couple. So.
Okay. I forgot. See, I don't remember every detail, so you
okay.
have to, you have
yeah,
to fill
no,
me
no.
in.
We were doing Fighting Temptations, and I was doing a lot of trying to direct, right? And it's tough when you're being, what I call babysitter for these celebrities when you're a personal assistant. Trying to do your own, have your own life. They, a lot of them think you're born and bred to be there,
Well, you work for them, right? They want you there all
them.
The time.
There's the boundaries right. when you become, there's no boundaries. I think they can, do whatever they want.
Right.
And that's not to say all of them because Nick never did that. Nick was.
My wife wants the same thing.
What's that?
My wife wants the same thing. There's no boundaries and she wants me to do everything she wants.
Yes. But I didn't marry a lot of these guys. So. But Nick wasn't like that. Nick was amazing. He was so respectful and just right. such a great person to learn from. You know, and then I'm on location with Cuba and I'm trying to shoot my own stuff and he had issues with that. And so it was kind of a you're fired / I quit.
Right. Well, what were you shooting during that time?
Actually, you know what I was shooting? That was the first year Project Greenlight was out and I wanted to enter. So on my day off, I decided to shoot something and he had issues with that. So fired me / I quit. So
just because of that one day.
Yep. Didn't like the fact that, you know, and to quote him, you're not a director when you're with me, which is retarded. So,
wow.
You know, can I have my own day off? But it was fine. It was actually a blessing because then I left and I went back to L.A. And at that point, I had already shot a film in L.A. that we were working on finishing post on. And it got me to the drive to finish it, to show this guy, look, I finished my movie.
Wait, which one was this?
It's called Dreaming in Black and White, a short film starring Malik Yoba. And the movie went on to win like 24 best short film awards all around the world at film festivals. It did amazing. It even got a little mini distribution run because it was, you know, people loved it. It was received really well. So it was a great, like, you know, screw you, look what I did.
So let's talk about that because it's important, because ever since the beginning, you sort of started putting people that are sort of known into your movies, which is hard for indie filmmakers to do. So this is one important reason I want to chat with you. That, I mean, I shoot a lot of indie films and I mean, you don't know who the hell is. I don't know what they're thinking, but they can never sell their movie because no one of any note, unfortunately, right? That's the way it works, that you need someone of some note to be in your movie so you can sell it. You know, just the way it
works. It's a business. No one gives a shit about your story and, you know, you might have the best story and you're going to tell your craft amazingly and you know, shoot such a pretty picture. But at the end of the day, if there's no one to put on that box cover, there's no way to sell it. And
right.
It's just the sad truth of this business.
So, I mean, basically, since you almost, not your first short, but one of your first films, you sort of had pretty much name actors in it, right? Who were they? Tell us the cast of that first short, Dreaming in Black and White.
Dreaming in Black and White was just Malik Yoba. Well,
didn't you have somebody else? I thought you had somebody else. I don't want to say.
No, not in Dreaming. Dreaming Black and I was just Malik Yoba, you know, New York on the cover. Now he's on the show Empire.
And how did you get him?
Malik is an amazing guy. I've known him for almost 20 years now as well. I was a PA on New York on the cover for first 2-3 years with seasons, whatever it was. And I was in LA trying to cast Dreaming in Black and White. And I was walking into the post office in North Hollywood or Universal, whatever. And as I'm walking in, about to walk in, Malik's walking out. And I stopped him. He's like, what are you doing here? I was like, I live here. He's like, yeah, I just moved out here too. And we just, you know, started catching up. And I said, hey, it's funny. How about you read my script? It's a short film that we did on racism. I'd love to have your input. You know, I'd love to have you involved. He read the script. We met up a couple of times. And then he, you know, supported. He supported me and said, yeah, I'll do your short. It's a nice, great script. I want to do it.
I mean, that's surprising that, I mean, first of all, it's great that he remembered you. He remembered a PA. That's awesome.
Yeah.
But secondly, that he actually said, yeah, I'll read your script and meant it. So
he actually meant it and he did it. And it's really, you know, he actually said something to me that day at the post office. And I've never forgot it. I never will. He said, you know, Joe, it used to be in this business, you know, it's who you know, right? Who you know. It's how you get ahead in this business. Who you know. And, you know, LA, everybody knows everybody, apparently, right? Everyone's a producer. But
everyone's a director.
And a director, right? He goes, but it's not really accurate. It's more who knows you and who gives a shit to actually do something for you. And that makes sense. And that really made, like, it really hit me, you know, which is why relationships are really important in this business.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, well, you want to take your friends with you. You don't want to work with just people you don't like all the time. That's for 20 years. That would be terrible in anything.
Yeah.
Any job, I think. Doesn't matter if film or not. But, okay, so you did that first short. What happened next?
That's a good question. Let's see. What do we do after that?
I'm getting to the features. That's the point. Like, you actually went straight to features almost immediately, right after that.
This is what happened next. So what I did was...
You didn't shoot 20 shorts. That's my point. You did not spend... and I talked about this in the first podcast with David, my brother. And basically, I said, shorts are a waste of time. And you sort of knew that intrinsically, right? After the first short, you went straight to a feature.
Yeah, because there's no money in shorts. A short film is a calling card. That's all it really is. It's an elaborate resume. Show look what I can do.
Right. Look, I'm
so
awesome.
So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to sell something. Right.
Right.
No, there's no distribution market for shorts. Not even now in this digital age. There really isn't.
Right.
It kind of coincides again with my being a celebrity assistant. I took took some time off between movies. So I went and got a job, and I was working with Val Kilmer as his assistant on the movie The Salton Sea. And on The Salton Sea was an actor named Danny Trejo on the movie. And I met Danny there. Danny and I became, you know, friendly on the movie. And after the movie was over, I stayed in touch with him. So my business partner and I at the time were putting together a documentary film called Yo Soy, which means I am in Spanish. And we were going to talk. It's basically, you've ever seen Jon Favreau's Dinner with Friends, you know, and he has like three or four celebrities and they sit around a table eating food and talking shit about Hollywood.
I have not, actually.
You haven't seen that?
No.
It's really good. It's funny. You know, I love Jon Favreau and I really like those.
This is a film or is this something he just did on?
It was a TV series.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll check it out.
I think it's called Dinner with Friends or something like that. So I want to do something like that, but just on the Latino community. You know, it's hard enough making it in this business, you know, here in the United States. What's it like doing it from Venezuela, from Colombia, from Mexico? You know, it's even harder.
Well, say your background just so they know, because you look like a white Jewish guy. Yeah. So tell them.
Worked for Hollywood.
Well, the first time I met you, I was like, aren't you a fellow Jewish brother?
Yeah, no, I'm actually a Catholic boy from Queens, New York. Mom and dad are Colombian.
Right, so you're Colombian.
Colombian. Parents right. were, you know.
We want our audience to know. We want our audience to know we're multicultural.
Which is yeah. So we want to do something with Latinos and get all these Latinos in the same room and see what it's like for them to tell their story. Be positive, you know.
Right.
So we had all these people attached at one point. We had like Shakira and Carlos Vives, a big Colombian singer. You know, John Leguizamo, Isai Morales, Hector Elizondo, Rosie Perez, everybody from Adam Rodriguez all the way up to Ricardo Montalban to do this. We had all these yesterday, like 30 of these amazing, amazing, talented, you know, Latino movie stars. So we started, part of the show was also doing a one-on-one interview with all these guys, getting a little bites. So we started doing that first because scheduling, you know, 30 of the top Latino celebrities to be in one room together was close to impossible.
Right.
So we started doing the one-on-one interviews, and while we're doing Danny Trejo's interview, I realized in the middle of his interview, hearing his story, that this guy needs a documentary of his own.
What do you mean? Who realized it? Like you and your business partner?
I did.
Okay. You had a business partner too at that time, right?
Yeah, yeah. My business partner and I were going through.
But I'm saying you saw after doing this interview, you're like, oh shit, Danny Trejo needs a documentary.
Yeah. I mean, midway through, listening to the stories he was telling us and how he was responding to our questions on camera. This guy has been through the trenches. He needs his own doc.
I mean, give us the quick overview. I mean, I'm sure everybody knows Danny Trejo, the tattooed guy, but can you just give us the quick one, that 10-second overview of him?
Danny, you know, Danny's the real deal. He's a thug, right, on TV. That's because he was one. He did, you know, 10, 11 years of prison time for armed robbery and drug selling. And now he turned his life around after prison to help people. And because of him helping people, he became who he is today.
So, and anyway, he's telling these stories and you're like, oh shit, this is fucking interesting.
Yeah, telling a story. I went to a grocery store, you know, a little deli with a hand grenade and robbed it, you know? So we put this bigger documentary, Yo Soy, on hold and talked to Danny and his agent, Gloria, and worked out a way to do a documentary on his life. So in that one, we had, you know, Val Kilmer, who was really good friends with Danny. Dennis Hopper, who was extremely close with Danny, I think they were sponsors. You know, Robert Rodriguez, the amazing director and producer.
Who actually is the one who actually sort of discovered Danny Trejo, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, in Desperado, right? I think. Oh, yeah, Desperado. So right. the knife wielding guy, you know?
So this became your first feature, a documentary about Danny Trejo, and you basically got everyone who's famous on that one.
Yeah. They didn't do it for me. All those people did it for Danny.
I get that, but you still worked it out.
But it was great. We had all, and Steve Buscemi as well, who was really, really, really tight with Danny.
Right.
But not only that, but we also got Danny's, you know, non-celebrity friends, you know, people who he's done time with, people, you know, family members. This guy named Eddie Bunker, who did time with Danny a long time ago, got Danny his first job on a movie set as an extra. Danny had to play convict and runaway train. Mm-hmm. So we did this documentary on Danny, and then that ended up going crazy at the film festival circuits. We had no idea what we were making when we made it. I mean, it's actually this movie talking about Danny's life and what he did and what he went through and how the struggles and how he got out of it. It's actually screened in a lot of the juvenile halls in California as part of the rehabilitation program. It's also played in New Mexico in their like intra-satellite system for all the inmates to watch.
So I'm going to show people. This is part of doing a video podcast because you actually have it on your website. Let me go to that real quick. All right.
Yep.
So I'm at Rock On Films, and I mean, I'm just going to show them real quick before I go. There's a lot of projects, obviously. You know, we're going to discuss some of these, and all of these have stars attached, so we'll go into it. But here's Danny's Champion. I have it brought up already. Let me play a little bit of it.
May 5th, 1968, there was a riot in Soledad, and me, Ray Pacheco, and Henry Quijada went to the hole. 24 years old, and I'm through. And I remember saying a prayer. I said, God, if you're there, then it's going to be all right. And if you're not, I'm screwed. Prison is the only environment in the world that you're going to be either a predator or you're going to be the prey.
I said, how do you keep from going crazy? And he said, you go crazy yourself, so they don't make you crazy.
He's about as tough a looking a guy as you'll ever run into.
He's scary.
Scary.
Scariest looking guy I'd ever seen.
You got to get that fear and turn it totally into madness.
So I just wanted people to see what we're discussing, that they can actually buy this DVD. let's
Amazon.
Let's sell it, baby. But, yeah, I mean, that looks like you got some serious fucking names in it. Actually looks like a great documentary, too. And I've seen it. It is a really good documentary. But just the trailer itself looks amazing. And you directed it, and you also edited it, right?
I co-edited it, yeah. The main editor was a really good friend of mine named Joe Larigo, who sacrificed and supported the cause for us and did an amazing job. And I also contributed with some of the editorial as well.
Is that when you first started sort of, like, really picking up like Avid and doing, you know, like modern day editing, sort of what's considered as opposed
yeah,
to film?
That was it. And as we're talking, we made this movie back in 2004 and released it in 2005. So mm-hmm. 10 years ago.
Well, I'm saying that's when you first started to get really into editing, heavily into it, right?
Yeah, a little bit before that, but yeah, pretty much.
Because now, I mean,
high hopes, actually. We did that first. Skipping
ahead, because now, I mean, we'll go back, but you're a post soup. So. And I don't know if you want to just tell them briefly, what are you doing currently, like right now, this second? And
right
because
now,
obviously you live in a hotel room.
I'm on location in Orlando. We're doing a show called La Voz Kids Season 3. It's basically The Voice, but in Spanish, for kids.
Right.
And it's an incredibly complex show. We have like over 20 cameras. And, you know, we shoot live in the studio at Universal a lot.
And, so, and you're responsible for the editing process, the whole post...
Yeah,
from
the post-production department.
You don't actually cut. You're just responsible for all the editors and whatever else has to happen there.
Right, but I've already had to cut a little bit, so yeah.
Oh, they're making you work. Okay.
Yeah, and it did some VFX already as well, some motion graphics.
Okay, cool. Well, I just wanted to establish what you're doing now as well, besides directing, you know, how you make a living as well. But,
yeah.
All right, so let's go back. Let's go back. So after you did this documentary, you said it blew up.
It blew up in a way I wasn't expecting, and in more of an educational way as opposed to an entertaining way. People... And it's funny, like, people give reviews, like, you know, people get, keyboard muscles. And when they're writing reviews, some people think it's the best documentary I've ever seen. Some people have said that Danny Trejo should actually kill me for the documentary and how it turned out.
Why? So, well, why is that?
Some people hated it. Some people like to be spoon-fed what they already know, which is Danny's a big movie star and blah, 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 blah. But what about the Danny you don't know? So
that seems like a way more interesting story anyway. So
it is. That's just why we made it. But right. People wanted to see more clips of Danny and in the movies that they've already seen. So I didn't quite get that. But regardless, it's actually helped a lot of people. Like, I'll never forget, we were at the Wine Country Film Festival in Northern California. And we had so many people wanting to see the movie that they actually took it out of the little theater they were going to put it in, and they rented us this huge theater in town to screen it in. And we had a packed house. Danny was extremely supportive of the movie, and he traveled all over the world with me at all these different festival screenings to be a part of it and be a part of the Q&A afterwards. And we're in it's right outside of Sacramento, I guess we were, in Wet Wine Country. And we're in this theater. And at the end, Danny and I get to the front, and they start asking questions from the audience. This guy that, 6'4", big Mexican guy, looked like, he'd done some time himself. And, was a gangbanger. Stands up, bawling, saying that what he watched on that screen was his life. And if it wasn't for his wife sitting next to him, he'd be dead. And he thanks Danny for being brave enough to share to the world what his story was and what he went through and how he helps people. And now that makes this guy want to go now and be like Danny and go now help kids and people who are hooked on drugs and alcohol stop doing that.
Well, that must have been really, that must have hooked you right away, that someone was so moved by something you did.
Yeah, I got choked up. It's tough not to. It's so emotional when you get that, you invoke that kind of response from somebody.
Yeah. That's true. Filmmaking could do that. That's why hopefully we're making some movies that will last beyond us,
Yeah.
At least that's the hope. But okay.
Yeah.
So what happened? So you got the movie done. You're getting a lot of publicity from it. How did you go about selling it and getting it into, DVDs? Because back then, this is 2004, right? It's not like we have... It's not that easy to self-distribute as it maybe is a little bit easier now. There's no real resources for filmmakers at that point.
Yeah, no, we weren't getting the offers we wanted. It's still a documentary at the end of the day, and a lot of people don't like watching documentaries. It's just not fun for them. So the revenue, the potential revenue is a lot lower than a narrative film. So already having put it,
Did you know that going in?
No. I learned it on the back end when it came time to sell it. So what I did with my partner was we ended up self-distributing it. We found a DVD manufacturer in Hong Kong and glass mastered 10,000 DVDs first and then started selling it ourselves. We got it into Best Buy, into Walmart, into
holy shit.
Target, Amazon.
How did you do that? How did you get into Best Buy? By calling them?
By calling, finding out who to talk to. And I called, and it helps when you have Danny's, and Danny's face on your box, and you have Val Kilmer, Robert Rodriguez, Hopper, Buscemi. It helps because it's still, in their eyes, a mainstream movie.
No, but okay. That's I didn't even know about some of this stuff. So you literally called the buyer at Best Buy, and you said what? What is the conversation you had? Because I'm sure people are interested in that.
Well, you got to call them and act like you've done this a million times. So, you call them and you're like, well, now it won't work because now it's completely different. The market's flooded with movies that they don't – there's no way to do it now. But well, back 10 years ago, it was easier.
I don't know if that's true because if you put you put a couple of people in it that people know and you sell it like – you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but they don't sell the filmmakers directly now because there's so many.
Yeah.
You have to go through an aggregator. You have to go through a sales agent who's going to rip you off. You have to go through somebody, that you're no longer getting the full share of your money now. So
right.
It makes it harder.
Okay. Well, so tell me what you did, though. You called up. You found the number.
Basically, it was over 10 years ago now. So I had this, great documentary. It's doing fantastic in the festival circuit. I'd love to sell you. How many copies do you want to buy? They're like, all right, well, send us a screener. So I sent them a screener, and they placed an order.
That's amazing.
We fulfilled the orders ourselves and sent it to their main hub, and then they dispersed it out to all the Best Buys that they thought would actually want to carry it. Not every Best Buy in the country had it. It's just whatever they thought with the demographic who would watch the movie and live in those areas, that's where it went. Mm-hmm. And the same thing on Netflix. It was on Netflix for a while.
Got it. So how does that whole process work, though? I don't know if you want to talk some specifics. I'm just curious myself. What percentage does Best Buy get? What percentage do you get of that sale? When they do sell it.
Well, they buy it at cost. So they buy it,
this is back in the day. I don't know what it is now, obviously, right?
Yeah, yeah. You tell them, the suggested retail price is $24.95. They're going to buy it from you for like $7.95 to $9.95 per disc. And that's what you make on it. But you didn't pay $24.95 on it. They can go sell it for that much if they want.
I see.
So we made it for, I think it ended up being like 70 cents per disc or something, 75 cents per disc.
So you make $7 to $10 a disc.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad.
It's probably better now than most filmmakers get.
Yeah, if they even get anything these days.
So, I mean, let's skip ahead a little bit. What's your recommendation now? What would a filmmaker do right now to sell their own movie if they can't get it distributed?
Now, the digital world, it's so much easier to get your movie on Hulu, and you know, you get one aggregator to get you on iTunes because they still are pretty strict at what content they sell on their site. But it's really easy now to self-distribute. You can go Vimeo Pro on demand, which I'm not sold on that platform yet, but it is a platform.
Well, Google Play, iTunes.
Yeah, iTunes, Hulu, Roku, Google Play, Amazon, Netflix.
So in your opinion, is there a reason to even go to I know we made a movie, but let's just talk like we're not going through some of this. Is there a reason to even go to a distribution person if you can basically do it yourself and actually keep more money?
You know, I'm actually beginning to question that these days. I used to think, you know, yes, because they have the better connections than you do. They've, you know, been able to nurture the relationships and hopefully have a legitimate deal that could translate to get your movie out. With studios, you want to get your movie to Lionsgate or Sony, whatever. But these days, I'm actually beginning to think that it's just as easy for the filmmaker, if they know what they're doing and they have a marketable film, to get it directly to the platform that's going to release it digitally themselves and keep most of the money. Not just, you know, give it a sales agent, you know, $100,000 in marketing fees and P&A and blah, 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 and then you get nothing at the end of the day.
I mean, go into that, because obviously not everybody knows these terms, that your movie to a distributor. This was my naive understanding maybe a couple of years ago, that you give your movie to a distributor and then you give him 15% and then you get everything else.
Oh, that's cute.
Does that sound right?
No, I wish that was the case. Yeah. Well, nowadays.
Yeah, how is it? How is the reality of this?
The cash flow drip. It starts off, you know, Niagara Falls falling down and it ends up, you know, leaky faucet by the time it gets to the filmmaker.
Right, because they're all taking these separate costs that first you're never going to see. They're flying somewhere. Yeah. They're paying for the hotels. They're paying for their quote unquote marketing things. Their hard costs, whatever the fuck that is.
Distribution 101. All right, let's say you got $100,000 in the box office your first weekend, and you know, and that's just like DVD sales, video sales, whatever. That's not theater sales. So right off the top, your distributor is going to take, you know, 20%, let's say. So let's say the distributor is Lionsgate. They're going to take 20%. Okay, great. So $80,000 left. Now it cost them $25,000 to put it out. Okay, so now that's $25,000 that's gone now. So what is that? $55,000 left, right? So you got $55,000 left that goes to your sales agent that got you that deal. That sales agent now is going to take, you know, let's say 10% for the sake of this conversation, 10% of that, right? So he gets his $5,500, and then now he as part of his deal can claim another $25,000 in marketing expenses, which I don't know what the hell that means, but.
It could be anything.
To go to film markets to sell your movie and make posters, I guess. And so he takes another $25,000 from that. So, you know, you end up at the end of the day with what was $100,000 with maybe $20,000 going back to you, if that. I mean, I don't know if my math was right there or not, but it's in the ballpark.
Right. I mean, you end up, you're lucky, I think, if you end up with 20%, right?
That's if you have a hit. But you know, usually the sales agent also has other expenses they get to claim too. There's distribution expenses as well, which is another cost, another $50,000 usually. So usually with sales agents, you end up when you know we have a bad deal with $100,000 in expense that they can claim. You never get a detailed itemized list on what the hell that is, right? So
right, especially as an indie filmmaker, right?
Losing $100,000.
I mean, especially as an indie filmmaker, there's no way, like, people are thinking, well, I'll demand in my contract.
Yeah, fuck the contract.
I mean, right. They can hide costs in other movies, take from other, right? I mean, they have a lot of movies. They represent 20, 30 films, I assume.
Yeah, it's like cross-collateralization. Is when the loss from one movie is eaten up by another movie that actually made money. But they figure out a clever way to hide that in the books.
So basically your recommendation is don't trust those motherfuckers.
Don't. So you basically worked your ass off, blood, sweat, and tears, to make a movie for someone else to sell and make money and pay the rent with.
So, I mean, but the other problem for an indie filmmaker like you, like me, is that we still have to figure out a way to make at least 20 grand or whatever the 20% beat that. Do you know what I mean? So let's say we do by some miracle get 20% of this, the distributor taking it, right?
Right.
And the seller's agent taking it, etc. How do we beat that? I mean, I know we don't have an exact plan here, but give us a gist.
How do you beat it, like, as far as, like, making more than 20?
You know, beat it, instead of going that conventional way, because a lot of indie filmmakers are now, what do I do with my movie? I mean, I've worked with a lot of directors where they actually, they don't have stars, you know? So they can't even go that route. They have to do it themselves. They have to. Like, how would you recommend they do it?
You know, honestly, if they don't have a star, they're even worse off. Because at least if they, you know, at least if we have a celebrity in our movie, right, that we can actually, people give a shit about and would support and watch a movie by the, you know, whoever it is, at least you have social media to back you up and get the word out and do some advertising. But if you don't have anybody on there, you know, you have Joe Schmo in it, who nobody knows, great. You know, maybe that guy's 48 Facebook friends will buy a copy. But that's about it. You know, it's really tough to get it out there. It's tough, and it's a sad part because, you know, filmmaking, you know, telling stories, right? Telling such great stories that you're passionate about. But at the end of the day, it's a business, and what drives the sales of the movie.
Right. I mean, someone searching on iTunes is not looking up some guy they don't know. They're looking up someone they know, obviously.
Right.
Unfortunately,
and that's what's
going
to be out, like, on the new release page on their site, you know?
Right. But still, I mean, the wisdom is still, well, try to put somebody, obviously, that people know into your movie and still make a high-quality movie. The other thing is, you can't do it now yourself. Trying to go through what, aggregators, or just you can't go on iTunes yourself. You have to go through still somebody else, right? There's still somebody else.
Yeah, you can't
blocking
go through iTunes
you.
Yourself. You have to go through an aggregator. But another route for somebody, maybe they do have a good movie and it's well made and the acting is fantastic and it's shot and looked well and the editing is fantastic, but they have nobody in it to sell it. Well, then the festival route is perfect for them, because then they can go and maybe start showing some awareness for this film that they right. have, and maybe it just ends up being a calling card for them. To get, you know, oh, this guy did a great job directing this. Maybe we can trust him to do, you know, this other movie which has a celebrity in it. Or, you know, there are distribution routes like Sony Classics that does pick up movies that don't have celebrities in it usually. But, you know, they get really, really small limited releases.
Right.
But they do still support the indie people. Who's another one? Like Fox Searchlight, I think, is another one that does that kind of stuff.
Well, their movies have been big lately with a lot of famous folks.
Yeah, but they don't, you know, they don't pick up as money anymore.
Right, right.
But the festival route would be the only chance to really get some sort of recognition for your work.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to end this. I think this is important just for filmmakers. Like, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. You've sold. I mean, tell folks, because we're talking about this, because you've sold four or five films, right?
Yeah, I've sold four or five films. I've been heavily involved in negotiation of all of them. Found right. most of the distribution myself for all of them.
Right. I mean, that's a big thing. Most indie guys go into, oh, I've written a script. I've shot
Fantastic.
A beautiful movie. It's so wonderful. Right.
Yeah.
And I shoot a lot of those movies, and I see how the struggle, you know, there's another director we're going to talk to in a couple of weeks, and the movie's Leaving Circadia. I don't mind mentioning, but they're having a struggle dealing with the selling aspect of it because they didn't put any real famous people in it, you know, and the movie's
yeah.
fantastic. So it's just really sad to see such a good film, such a great cast, but no one of recognition really. So no one's really paying attention. It's harder
right.
for them, you know.
I've seen the movie, and it's a great movie. It's a really good movie. It yeah. just unfortunately there's no marketing behind it. No one's going to put any money behind it because there's nothing to market.
I'm going to talk to him. He has to self-distribute, so we're going to discuss that at length. Anyway, okay, so cool. So that was your first film, that basically your first feature you sold. That's you got lucky. Well, you picked the right project.
Picked the right project, got the right support from the right people. Like, just like Malik said, who knows you and who gives a shit? And he was right.
I'm going to go to your webpage again, because let's go. I think the next one was High Hopes. Is that right?
Yeah, so High Hopes. So at the end of...
Do you want me to show the trailer? Or
yeah,
you want to tell the story first?
No, go ahead. You can tell the trailer.
All right. And this is picked up by Lionsgate.
Obviously, Sean Connery, he's playing the role of James Bond.
Yeah.
He'll be reading for the part of the freshman. Any questions?
No, I think I'm ready.
Okay, let's see how it goes.
Ha, 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 ha.
Yes. You know you're feeling it.
David Faustino, everybody.
Wow, that is really
and
cool.
And Corin Emick. Just bang with it. Come on. Jason Mewes.
Losers.
What?
Just bang with it. Did Ben tell you that he wrote a screenplay?
I'm a producer.
All you have to do is keep an eye on him. He's just an over-medicated mute.
She didn't tell you he was retarded?
So I just wanted people to see, once again, it's full of people we've seen before, you know, on TV and whatever else. So tell us a story of how this happened, because we also saw Trejo Productions there, right?
Yeah, Trejo 4.0. I, at the end of working on Champion, almost done, I get a call from Danny, and he's like, Holmes, get over to my house, Holmes. And I thought I was in trouble. I was like, what did I do? And I'm all scared, and I drive up to his house, and he's in the backyard with his ex-business partner, and he throws a script at me and says, hey, do you want to direct this? I'm going to produce it. And I got the money through some people. I was like, yeah. He's like, well, don't you want to read it first? I was like, sure, it'll be fine. Well, I'm not going to say no. So
wait, so he throws a script in your lap, like, don't you want to do this? Don't you want to read it? You're like, it's good.
That's fine. We'll work it out. Don't worry. It's a $100,000 budget. Okay. He's like, but we have to be shooting in 2 weeks. I was like, holy shit. Okay. In 2 weeks. And at this point, we've cast nobody except for Danny. And I haven't read the script.
It's his movie. It's easy to get him.
Of course. So I went back, went to my business partner, and we read the script, and the script needed a complete rewrite. So we had my business partner rewrote the script, all of it, in about a week, the entire script, a page one rewrite. And we, Danny and I, at that point, looked for all the locations ourselves. We hired the crew. We did all the casting. 2 weeks later, we were shooting.
Jesus.
Kind of lined up.
That's not, I mean, you didn't have any support. It was just you started to hire crew right away, I assume, right? Like,
sort of. We didn't really have money for crew at first for pre-production,
right?
You know, we only had a $100,000 budget, so we ended up spending it on production itself, put everything on screen as much as we could. We had a lot of locations for free. A lot of people hooking up Danny because they love Danny. Everybody loves Danny. All the actors hooked, you know, we were on like a SAG ultra low budget. You know, these guys made $75 a day. You know, we're talking Robert Rodriguez is in it, Andy Dick, Eddie Furlong, David Faustino, Damien Dallas Page, Jason Mewes, you know, Corin Nemec. Great, amazing cast. And all these guys jumped on just out of pure support for the movie and Danny and I. So it was good to have that. And we shot the whole movie in 11 days with two cameras. It was a hard shoot, but it turned out pretty well at the end. It was a fun movie. The crew was amazing. And then we, you know, cut the movie again. Same editor, Joe Larigo, came on board and supported us unconditionally again. And then I, you know, at the end, I did a little bit of cutting as well. And then, but I mean, the majority of the movie was cut by Joe. And then we started going to try to sell it, and we ended up getting a deal with Lionsgate, and which kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier. The first question Lionsgate asked me is, before even watching the movie, who can we put on the box, on the artwork, on the box art? And I said, the whole cast. They're like, you're telling us we can put all of these cats on it? Like, yeah. Oh, and I also forgot Lacey Chabert from, you know, Party 5 was also in it.
She's hot.
So I'm like, yeah, we have releases on everybody. You can, you know, do a nice little montage of everybody. So like, great, we'll make you an offer soon.
So literally the whole cast was basically famous, semi-famous, A-B stars type of a thing. The whole cast. You didn't have anybody who was just a nobody?
We had a few civilians, yes.
Yeah. Only the crew was like nobody knew, right?
So, I mean, it was fantastic now to get that offer from Lionsgate.
Wait, so you went to Lionsgate. That was the first person you went to when they immediately...
No, we went to a few people first, but Lionsgate made the biggest offer. In fact, we are having a little bidding war going with a company called Think Film, which is no longer around.
They were huge. No, they were big for a long time, right?
They were huge for a while.
Yeah.
Think made an offer, and then Lionsgate made an offer, and we kind of played each offer off each other. And then eventually Lionsgate got tired of negotiating and they blew Think Film out of the water because they had more resources to do so.
Right.
So Lionsgate made a better offer. We accepted, delivered to them, and they released it in Canada and the United States on DVD and VOD.
So now you went from basically self-distributing to directly to a big distributor.
Yeah.
I mean, how was that process, obviously?
It wasn't that bad, actually. It was fun. I'm actually still in contact and friends with the rep that bought it from us. So they put it out, pretty quick, like they promised. And we've actually seen money on it. They pay.
Right.
The movie, it's a pot stoner comedy. So it even the Facebook page every day still gets, a dozen likes from people.
And you're still getting checks. This is 10 years later, right?
Seeing checks, yeah.
This is 10 around? 9, 10?
It's been a few years and it's still making rounds.
So you thought you were going to be the next A-list director. I mean, like, your first film does great. The second one is sold in like a matter of what, weeks?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's pretty sweet.
I thought I was on the way.
You're on cloud 9.
Pretty much.
Yeah. All right. So I mean, you're still selling films, obviously, but why is it so hard to just break through and get into that Hollywood picture? Like, what was going on? Were you taking meetings at that point? What was going on exactly there?
I took some meetings. I signed with a manager, in this town that it's a fucking con artist. Everyone's, going to sell you the world, but will they actually deliver? Probably not. You learn that the hard way.
It's difficult. It was difficult 10 years ago. Would you imagine it's even more difficult now with so many people doing this?
Yeah. The problem is, because of how I was able to put together these films on my own and create these projects, now I have agents and managers wanting to sign me simply because they can sit back, let me do the work, because they know I'm not going to sit back and wait for them. I'm going to go create another project.
Right. And just make them money, basically.
Basically. Right. So I realized that, and I haven't had an agent or manager since for that very reason. I'm not going to do the work for someone else to get the money from me. I've been doing nothing.
So what happened to – let's go to the next one, because right after that – let me see if I have it. Was that Pizza Man? Was that
I think it was Pizza Man that was next, yeah.
So this was a way bigger budget. I don't know if you want to discuss it. Let me play it first, all right?
Yeah.
Well, before I play it, this is a Frankie Muniz superhero movie that actually – well, I shot it, by the way. So I think that was the first feature we worked on, right?
Yeah, that was the first feature.
And this project was hard.
Oh, actually, wait. Let's not talk about this one yet. Let's talk about the other short film that you and I met on, Yitzi.
I don't think you actually have it on your site. But no, I'm not sure if I have a link to it. But yeah, if you want to mention it, tell us about that.
So, a mutual friend of ours called me up and asked me to direct the film. Short film that he wrote, and I met with Vitaly and
who's this
actor. Remember that first time?
I remember the first time.
Yeah, I thought you were the biggest dick. I was like, I gotta go.
I do have a big dick, thank you.
It's funny what we hear.
Right. So, this is live.
So we did this short film, but I already told myself I'm not doing any movies anymore unless it's somebody in it that can actually sell it, because it's just a waste of time.
Is this right after you did High Hopes? How soon
just
after?
Just a few years afterwards.
Okay. What did you do between then?
It's developing projects, trying to get other movies going. That's right. The hardest part, is finding financing for films. So I was in the process of doing that, and I just moved back to New York in early 2009. So now it's late 2009. And I get this call from an old friend asking me to direct this movie that he wrote. It's a short film. I was hesitant, but you know what? Why not? It's a good script. It was funny, and they're willing to pay make an offer to Jason Mewes, who I already did High Hopes with, to come out to New York and shoot it with us. So Jay read the script. He liked it. We worked out the deal, did the contract, and he flew out to New York with his wife. And we shot this fun short film in, 3 days we shot it or something. And that's where I met Vitaly.
Cool. So, since we're talking about the film, what happened with the film?
It did a bunch of festivals simply because of Jay was in it, because Jason Mewes was in it.
There you go back to the problem. Like, it does a couple of festivals. It helps maybe you a little bit because you did something in another project.
On the website,
Right, it's not even on the website.
It's not even on the website.
And I've told this on the first podcast, like I basically stopped doing shorts. Like there's almost, unless it's really like a high concept type of a thing, which is like you can expand your horizon.
Yeah.
You know, you can try new things, whatever.
Sure.
But there's no reason that any filmmaker, unless you're around 20 years old, right?
Yeah.
Or 18, maybe 18 is a
You're learning the craft. You're learning how to, you know, fucking tell a story. Then sure, go waste some time doing that.
All right. But I always figure, like, why don't you just, you know, write a script, shoot a scene from your feature, shoot another scene later, shoot another scene, and then put it together, and then you have a feature that you can sell, as opposed to doing 20 shorts. But anyway, of course.
I always tell people at film festivals, the main question I get asked a lot is, you know, what, you have any advice for starting out filmmakers? And I said, if you don't have, are you writers? Like, no. Well, then you need to get the bad movies out of your system. So you know, go learn how to make a movie. So what's your favorite movie? Take a scene from that movie, okay? Shoot that scene. You're not going to sell it. You're not going to get anybody in it. You're not going to do anything with it. It's just mainly for you to learn how to compose your shots, compose your story, tell your story, learn how to use a microphone, learn how to use your camera, and do that, you know? And now computers come so preloaded with, you know, mini studios in it that you can do it for close to nothing, you know? But in the meantime, you have material readily available, you know?
Right, and as soon as you get out of your system, stop making those shorts.
Right, start writing a script and or work with someone to write a script if you can't write. And go. I've seen people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on short films when you can spend $100,000 on a feature with people in it and actually get some distribution and not waste your time.
Well, you actually bring up a good point. We didn't discuss this yet, but in 2006 when you made High Hopes, what year was this? 2006?
5.
2005. $100,000 in 2005 for film, like now people know they can do that. Back then it was a little bit, probably an iffy proposition.
Yeah, it was tough. It was really hard to do it. And we had two cameras. And it's a funny story behind the cameras. So when I did the short film, Shooting in Black and White, at that time I had a relationship with Jerry Bruckheimer Films and his people. So I had already worked on Pearl Harbor and on Gone in 60 Seconds, both produced by JB Films. And we needed the gear, and Jerry Bruckheimer's people got us a great Panavision package. And while talking to Bob Harvey over at Panavision, the president of Panavision, he says, I will oblige because of Jerry and our relationship with Bruckheimer Films, but on one condition, that when you do your next movie, and if you have money to do to pay like for camera rental, you come back to us. I said, deal. And I'm a man of my word. So fast forward now to High Hopes. And we had, you know, about $15,000 out of the $100,000 budgeted for camera rental. I call up Bob Harvey and said, hey, remember me? He's like, yeah, how you doing? How'd that movie turn out? It's like, great. Listen, I'm doing a feature, my first, you know, real narrative feature. And I promise you I'd come back if I have money, and I have money. And he started laughing. He's like, well, wow, you actually came back. Usually people just go on to the next camera house to get the next freebie. They don't actually come back to you. What do you need? So I faxed them over. This is when we're still using fax machines.
I have money, but it's very little.
It's very little. That's pretty much what he said. I showed him the list, and he's like, yeah, what you're asking for alone is $100,000. But because you actually came back to me, I'll take the 15 grand for all this whole list. And he gave us everything we needed. You know, I think it was the Sony F800s. Back then, which is
right,
wasn't that the same movie? I think that's the same camera that Rodriguez used on Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
This is actually interesting too. I mean, you started off in film, immediately made the transition to digital. I fucked that up. I said digital, but it's digital. So, there's obviously a lot of discussion: cinematographers, directors, film, digital, blah blah blah. And this is back in the day when obviously digital is becoming more widespread. So, did you even care?
I it's funny. I hated video, and it was hard for me to make the switch. But then, the DP, our DP on that one, Dana Gonzalez, showed me how this camera, how well it did, and I actually liked it, and I think it worked well for the movie. So I went with it. And you know, film is expensive too. You know, when
you couldn't afford it back then. I mean, you'd have to get it developed. Post-process, no. Put on an interpositive, a telecine, and all those other things that have to happen. Yeah, I mean, how much would that cost?
More than the budget of the movie.
More than the $100,000, right.
So
you had no choice, basically.
So we had no choice, so we did it. But it worked really well, and the movie, I think, looks pretty good for what it is.
Well, you also did on digital your documentary, obviously, right?
Yeah, that one we did all, you know, we shot mini-DV.
Of course, right.
On the Danny Trejo one, Champion.
Did anyone ever complain, bitch about it when you were selling it, that this is on mini-DV?
Not back then. Now I do.
No. I mean now, this is over 10 years later, right? This is 2004.
Yeah, now I hear that all the time from people. Like, iTunes won't even put it on because it wasn't originated in HD.
Oh, that's interesting. Can you up-res it to make it look sort of like that?
I can, but they can tell.
Right, you should still do that.
I tried that.
So the second one was a digital, and then you've never shot film technically again except on iRide. Well, we'll talk about iRide alone as a trailer, but you've never shot another film that wasn't digital.
No.
And will
after
you...
that was... was Red.
With
I
us.
Mean, everything after that was Red.
With us, right? When I had the Red one, etc.
Yeah.
Right. And that obviously, what did you think of that whole transition from the Sony F800, did you say?
F800, yeah.
To the Red. Like, how big of a transition, in your opinion, was that?
For
digital cinematography. No. Say it again.
I actually felt like when we went to the Red that I was actually going back to film. That's what the look to me, which is what it's all about. Because back then, all these companies are making all this software and converters and plugins to make your video look like it originated on film, right?
Right.
You spend thousands of dollars to apply this look, film look, to your video.
24p.
24p film look, yeah. So the Red camera, I felt like, had all that built in. It looked like film to me. It still does.
Oh, yeah. Well, now it's way better with the Dragon. So yeah, anyone who wants to rent it, please come to.
Now it's intense.
It's pretty crazy. I mean, 16 and a half stops as opposed to like 12 and a half, 13 or so.
You're talking about me or your Red?
Let's go back to, the rental prices. All right. No, but this is interesting to know from a director's point of view who was shooting film. You literally were as learning on film before DV, and then you switched immediately all digital. So
yeah, I mean, I was literally at a Bolex, winding it up and shooting for 15 seconds. And
15 seconds. You're like, I got tired of the 15-second limit. Okay, so we were moving on to, after the short, you did Pizza Man. This is a good time to stop. This will be a two-parter since our conversation goes into depth and takes us through all of his work. So stay tuned for part two next week, where we continue our chat about his biggest budget movie thus far, a superhero flick called Pizza Man, starring Frankie Muniz, and also our current film that we co-produced called Other Plans, starring Jamie Kennedy, which we'll also discuss next week. Don't forget, you can email us at info@photographyofdirector.com if you have any show ideas or would even want to be on the show. Please let us know.